From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I was in a house last night that was by on my own. It isn't something that made me lose confidence in what I'm doing, because my wife understands, and I have children from this size on down, and even in their young age, they understand. I think they would rather have a father or a brother or whatever the situation may be, who will take a stand in the face of any kind of reaction from narrow-minded people, rather than to compromise and later on have to grow up in shame and in disgrace.
36 years ago today, Malcolm X was assassinated. We'll hear his speech he gave a week before he was killed. And the president of California University flunks SAT tests. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A crew member plotting sonar readings on a U.S. submarine that collided with a fishing vessel has told investigators he briefly stopped performing the task because he was distracted by the civilian guests in the control room. Those guests were large campaign contributors. The National Transportation Safety Board also said yesterday the Navy has determined the submarine's sonar crew detected the Japanese boat 71 minutes before the submarine collided with it while performing an emergency rapid ascent drill. A civilian was allowed to sit at the helm of the submarine, and another was allowed to pull the levers that initiated the drill. But the Navy is now saying the two were closely supervised. The submarine rammed a Japanese fishing vessel, killing 9 people. The submarine's 3 top officers have declined to talk with NTSB investigators about events leading to the collision until the Navy completes its own investigation. Senator John McCain and 4 colleagues met with the Ecuadorian president in Quito yesterday to seek continued support for the $1.3 billion U.S. military aid package to neighboring Colombia. The senators are touring the region to defend Plan Colombia, which they claim is necessary to fight drug trafficking, but which critics say will be used to shore up the Colombian military in its war against rebels. Ecuador signed an agreement in 1999 letting the U.S. military make surveillance flights over drug-producing regions in Central and South America from an airfield in Manta. That deal and Plan Colombia have raised fear among Ecuadorians that their country will become a staging ground for U.S. military intervention in Colombia, sparking retaliation by guerrilla and paramilitary groups who take payments to protect the drug trade. The United Nations plays host to its second summit of the warring sides in Congo amid new optimism that the 6 nations involved are finally prepared to make good on promises to abide by a 1999 ceasefire deal. New pledges by Rwanda and Uganda to pull troops out of Congolese towns and a willingness by Congo's president to work with a regional mediator have raised hopes that the 2-day meetings starting today will move the peace process forward. The summit is expected to culminate with the adoption Thursday of a UN resolution mapping out a timetable for the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the massive, resource-rich Central African nation and the simultaneous deployment of UN military observers to oversee their departure. And we go now to Madison, Wisconsin, where last night the first vote was taken on making a city in East Timor a sister city with a city in the United States. Norm Stockwell is with us, who's with WORT in Madison. Can you tell us what happened, Norm Stockwell?
The City Council of Madison, Wisconsin voted last night to establish a sister city relationship with the community of Ainaro, East Timor. It's the first such relationship between a city in the United States and a community in the newly independent nation. East Timor was rocked by violence a little over a year ago when a resounding vote for independence ended the nearly 25-year-long occupation by Indonesian troops. Following the vote, paramilitary forces killed thousands and destroyed much of the small country's infrastructure. Ainaro, one of the hardest hit, had over 95% of its buildings destroyed, according to Diane Farsetta, who served as an election observer in 1999 and now heads the Madison-Ainaro Sister City Alliance. Farsetta says one of the goals of the Sister City Project is to support independence and self-determination for the East Timorese people. Madison, Wisconsin now has 9 sister cities, including communities in Cuba, Nicaragua, Vietnam, and El Salvador. These relationships are seen as having mutual benefit. The people of the United States often have as much to learn from them as they have from us, says Farsetta. Last night's resolution passed without opposition and was co-sponsored by 10 city alders and Madison Mayor Sue Bauman, who has paid personal visits to several of Madison's sisters.
That report from Norm Stockwell at WORT in Madison, Wisconsin. And finally, the British military resumed test firing depleted uranium shells yesterday for the first time since suspending the tests earlier this year over fears that the ammunition could cause cancer. NATO's use of ammunition containing armor-piercing depleted uranium in bombing campaigns in Bosnia and in Yugoslavia. It sparked concerns it may have caused serious illnesses in peacekeeping troops. A Scottish lawmaker had called for a moratorium on use of the shells until a screening program could be set up for soldiers and civilians who believe they may have been affected by exposure to them. But tests at a range in southwest Scotland were resumed over the protests of activists, lawmakers, and people living nearby.
I, too, sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, "Eat in the kitchen," then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful we are and be ashamed. I, too, am America.
Langston Hughes, I Too, over the Brooklyn Sax Quartet, here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! The president of the University of California wants to stop using SATs as a requirement for admission to the state's university system. In a speech to the American Council on Education on Sunday, Richard Atkinson said that standardized college tests have worsened educational inequities and distorted the way young people learn. Atkinson's decision came several years after the Latino Eligibility Task Force had urged that scholastic achievement tests be eliminated in order to equalize the access by African Americans and Latinos to higher education. Earlier, California had eliminated its affirmative action program. The proposal would need the approval of the Faculty Senate and the University System's Governing Board. If adopted, an end to SATs in California would push other large school systems to follow suit. So far, only small colleges such as Mount Holyoke and Bowdoin have dropped the standardized testing requirement. We turn now to Eugene Garcia, who is a dean of the Graduate School of Education at UC Berkeley and chair of the Latino Eligibility Task Force, which recommended the abolishing of the SAT. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. So what about the decision of the president at University of California? Now, you had pushed for this years ago.
Well, we had done a fairly comprehensive analysis of a number of sort of roadblocks or barriers to minority and Latino, specifically underrepresentation in the University of California. Keep in mind, the University of California is a very large public institution in the state, and its mission is to serve the citizens of California, and less than 4% of the Latino students in California, although they make up close to 40% of the K-12 population, are even eligible to attend the University of California. The Regents specifically asked us, a task force of faculty members from across the University of California, all its 9 campuses, to look into this issue, and we essentially reported that there were a number of things the university could do. First and foremost, it could rid itself of a tool that was being used quite extensively by the campuses to make decisions about admissions, and that was, of course, the SAT, and very specifically the SAT-1. We felt that eliminating the SAT-1, because of the problems it presented to poor students, minority students, and women, could very much affect the numbers of students who could participate in the very good University of California system.
Eugene Garcia, we're also joined by Ted Spencer, who's Director of Admissions at the University of Michigan. Now, you favor the use of SATs. Is that right, Mr. Spencer?
Yes, and thank you for having me on this morning. I certainly understand all of the issues surrounding the whole testing process, and particularly as it pertains to minority students. But I do think there is a benefit, and I think that the biggest thing that universities, colleges, and in fact maybe educational systems should do is to use the test in the proper context. We at Michigan use the test as one of many factors when we make our decisions about students coming in. And of course, you can't get into the University of Michigan if you have just strong test scores and weak every place else in terms of the things that we value. But at the same time, we think that there is a correlation between strong test scores, strong grade point averages. And at our place, graduation rates are very strong. We graduate 85% of the students that come here, and our minority graduation rates are also very high.
We're also joined. Yes, Eugene Garcia.
Yeah, those are the same things we found at the University of California. In other words, students, once you hold constant their SAT scores, the University of California graduates about 85 to 90% of the people, students it admits, independent, by the way, of their SAT scores. So one of the most revealing analyses we performed 4 years ago, and we've done several analyses since at the more selective universities at Berkeley, UCLA, and San Diego, is that the SAT just does not predict. So it doesn't add value in a very substantive way to who can succeed and who cannot. As we've already indicated, as Ted has indicated, once you get a student into the University of California, much like they get into University of Michigan, independent of their SAT score, they do pretty well. They graduate at a pretty good rate. So we really felt that this disadvantaged a set of students right at the outset because they didn't get considered very well.
Why don't
they use this?
Why don't Black and Latino students do as well on SATs?
Sure. Two or three reasons. We looked at, first of all, the substance of the test itself. There have been a number of studies which looked at we might call the cultural bias and the language bias of the test. I grew up in the southwestern United States, and Spanish was my first language. This test is an English test. It's also heavily weighted verbally. That is, if you're good with words, you've got lots of vocabulary, you have an environment in which the English vocabulary, particularly academic English vocabulary, is developed, then you're going to do pretty well on this test compared to a student who didn't have that experience. So right at the outset, the test essentially is essentially biased towards a set of kids, a set of experiences one might have outside of school, independent of school, that has to do with what the test actually assesses. In addition, this test, as everyone knows, is highest correlation is with parental education and parental income. So again, there seems to be something insidious about the advantages of living in a situation in which both your parents have gone to college, and the kinds of experiences that may be provided by not only that parental notion or knowledge base, but also what that brings with them in terms of the economic privilege. So combine that with the and very nice historical analysis was just written about a year ago about how the SAT was developed. It was developed in the 1930s, 1940s. It was normed on a group of white males attending the Ivy League. Its intent was to measure something that Dick Atkinson knows, because he's a psychologist, was something we called intelligence at that time. Well, we've come a long way in terms of understanding how the mind works and how to assess the way the mind works. And the SAT has not changed a lick. It is essentially based on 1930s, 1940s psychology. That's why the SAT-2s, which are more achievement-oriented, are much better measures of what one has learned as opposed to some general notion of what kind of genetic material one brings to the intellectual capabilities. And so the test, for lots of reasons, may in fact be biased towards a set of students who aren't like the ones that the test was designed for, and whose theories about the mind essentially were developed for.
We're also joined by Bob Schaefer, Public Education Director of Fair Test and co-author of Standing Up to the SAT and Test Scores Do Not Equal Merit. Bob Schaefer, this history of the SAT actually is a part also of the eugenics movement, isn't it?
Good morning, Amy and Jean and Ted. Yes, very much so. The SAT's roots, not necessarily its contemporary practice, but its history, are rooted in perhaps the ugliest portion of American social science. It was developed by people who believed in the natural superiority of white European males. The original first head of the College Board, for whom the library at the Educational Testing Service is named, was the president of the American Eugenics Society, who wrote about how we need to purify the race by decreasing breeding of inferior populations. He did repudiate that on his deathbed, but that was long after the test was invented. Now, a fair test would not suggest that the current designers, manufacturers of the SAT, or its proponents necessarily hold such views. I think probably very few of them do. But when you base a test on that perspective and built upon it year after year for consistency, there are still some of the traits of cultural biases and assumptions about what kind of skills are important and who's superior that linger.
Ted Spencer, as an advocate of the use of SATs, not the only determinant of whether a person will get in, but using it, how do you explain, as director of admissions at University of Michigan, why blacks and Latinos do worse on them? And isn't that a cause of concern for you?
Well, it is a cause of concern, and that's why we look at so many other factors. I must say that we, for years, have, because we're not certain whether there's cultural bias or racial bias or gender bias or geographic bias in the exams, we still try to balance the process by looking at many other factors. And I even think the board even recommends that in terms of not making the test the only reason for admitting a student or denying a student. And so we don't do that. And I think that colleges and universities for years have gotten away from the notion that taking the test as being the primary piece for admitting a student is not a good idea, that it doesn't really give you the good fit that you're looking for with students.
Why use them at all?
Well, I think that the more information you have about any student, the better you are at making a good decision about that student, whether you have information about their extracurricular activities, their work experience, the SAT-2, the SAT-1, all of that kind of information helps us in terms of making a good decision about that student in terms of whether that student is would have a strong opportunity of doing well in a very competitive environment.
Well,
I think the more competitive the school, the more information like this that you have, the better you are able to make a decision that will pretty much be the right kind of fit for both the students and the university.
Well, Bob Schaefer, what's wrong with having that extra information?
Well, if the extra information were one factor, perhaps it would add something. But what's wrong is the larger process of setting up a system whereby over 1.25 million high school seniors are forced to take this test, believe that it is used in formulas by many schools to determine who is eligible for admission, and indeed the system that Dr. Atkinson and Dr. Garcia are trying to replace at the University of California has an arbitrary formula which very heavily weights SAT and SAT-1 scores to admit more than half the class at the UC campuses. There are many other schools which misuse the College Board test with cutoff scores for admission to specific programs, or scholarships. And indeed, the interveners in the recent Michigan affirmative action suit, the civil rights groups who came into the case, claimed that Michigan was misusing the test in the past. All those factors together suggest that a better route is the one that some 300 colleges have already taken, and we're glad to see the University of California on the brink of joining them, and that is to make the test optional in the admissions process, so it's not required, so we don't have the hysteria, so we don't have kids buying high-priced coaching courses, or rather their parents buying it. We don't have counselors gaming the test by labeling certain kids disabled so they get extra time, and the test company responding by attaching a scarlet letter to their scores. Let's look at what really matters, which is performance over time. Admissions offices and the test optional schools can look at 3.5 years of high school performance, which includes lots of tests, in high school, and essays and projects and extracurricular activities and community service, and they can look at that kid in context and what he or she has done in life, obstacles they've overcome, and make a judgment in the same way we make those judgments at most other places. Test scores are not necessary to do high-quality admissions, even at the most selective schools in the country.
Gene Garcia, we're going to have to break for stations to identify themselves, but I'll get your comment after the break. We're talking to Bob Schaefer, Public Education Director of Fair Test, a group that is against the use of the SAT. He's written the book Standing Up to the SAT and Test Scores Do Not Equal Merit. Eugene Garcia, Dean of the Graduate School of Education at UC Berkeley, Chair of the Latino Eligibility Task Force, and Ted Spencer with us from Michigan, Director of Admissions at the University of Michigan. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with them, and then we'll hear a speech 36 years ago from Malcolm X. He died 36 years ago today, assassinated in Harlem, New York. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the latest education story, University of California president wanting to stop using SATs as a requirement for admission to the state's university system. Our guests on the phone right now, Ted Spencer, director of admissions, University of Michigan, Bob Schaefer, public education director of Fair Test, speaking to us from Florida, and Eugene Garcia, dean of the Graduate School of Education, UC Berkeley, and chair of the Latino Eligibility Task Force, which is the region's task force which recommended abolishing the SAT years ago. Eugene Garcia, you wanted to add a comment.
I just wanted to say in our analysis and our recommendations, we did not recommend eliminating sets of information which could include achievement tests. We felt, however, those tests should be aligned with what the states, particularly California, is teaching in its schools. We felt the SAT did not align with the state standards, that doesn't now, and therefore you're holding some kids to a different set of standards than others. So if you want to get an assessment, we have no problem with that. We just think it ought to be an appropriate one. The other last point I wanted to make had to do with a set of reviews we did to look at the effects tests having on the students themselves and on the schools which they attend. Keep in mind that a test is not a neutral intervention. Most of us think that we take a test and we go in and we do our best and we go away and we forget about it. That's not true. Those of you who've ever taken a high stakes test, particularly if you're a minority student, the data is very clear. It's if you do badly on that test, through no fault of your own, you've gone to a bad school or not the best school, you've been taught a curriculum that isn't aligned with essentially what someone is testing, and you get a bad score, if you think that doesn't affect you, that's just absolutely nonsense. And we have very good data now that suggests, particularly for blacks, particularly for Latinos, particularly for women, that continuing information about how they do on these high-stakes tests begins to affect them intellectually. They begin to believe they are intellectually inferior. So a test itself, like the SAT, that does not measure appropriately what a student can do or what the student has learned in an academic environment is not a neutral intervention. it unfortunately can disadvantage that student later on in their own self-perception. Colleagues in social psychology have been very clear about demonstrating that. So for reasons that have to do with the student themselves, the culture of testing, which is now being quite promoted in schools, I mean, schools are teaching to the test, not teaching content, they're teaching to the test. Kids are spending so much time preparing to take tests. As President Atkinson indicated, we've got to teach kids how to negotiate the world, how to solve problems, how to learn mathematics and science, not how to take tests.
Ted
so
Spencer,
there's a set of issues here that are beyond those that have to do with whether or not the test, which we've already demonstrated, is inappropriate.
Ted Spencer, let me ask you, as Director of Admissions, University of Michigan, if you couldn't use these tests, would it matter?
Well, I'm certain we could probably make good decisions without the test, and I would not suggest that would not be possible. I, again, have to say that I think that the test can encourage, in many cases, a different type of behavior. I don't think it's always negative. I mean, I think that in some cases, the fact that students have some carrot out there for them to strive toward does, in fact, help them, and in some cases, school systems, to try to get the students to a level where they could succeed or do well. I do think that there is an over amount of attention given to preparing for these exams, and that students and parents, the anxiety level is way too high about toward these exams. I do think also that achievement tests may, in fact, be a better measurement in many cases of a student's ability, particularly minority students and Latino students, all minority students. But I do think that yes, we could operate without them. I do think, although, that doing that will probably do nothing more than set a new set of standards. I mean, when you look at grade point averages across the country, minority students with A averages and B averages, there's still a significant drop-off with minority students and majority students, even in that regard. So it would mean that you'd have to establish a new bar, and I don't know what all that would lead to.
Bob Schaefer of Fair Test, how did ETS, the Educational Testing Service, end up being able to rope all these universities into buying, using? I mean, this is a corporation, right, the SAT?
It's about a $500 million corporation in nonprofit format, though it pays its president somewhere in excess of $400,000 a year in total compensation and benefits. The book Dr. Garcia referred to, Nick Lehman's The Big Test, that came out a year ago, devotes a large chunk to explaining the huge marketing campaign the Educational Testing Service and College Board engage in to get California to adopt the SAT. It's the crown jewel of testing. Fully one in every eight kids in the United States who take the SAT-1 are in California, and more than one quarter of the kids who take the SAT-2 live in California because of the state's testing requirements. So they made a major push to get California in. The way they sell it to other schools, I think, is particularly insidious. Tech schools don't pay for the test scores. Kids and their parents do. Many colleges, which don't even use the scores in any real way because they admit the vast majority of their applicants, so long as they're alive and have a tuition check that accompanies them, love what they get for free from the College Board, which is all kinds of demographic information that test takers fill out as part of registering for the test. So they can use the SAT data, not the test scores, for what's most important to most non-selective institutions, and that's called yield management, making sure there are tuition check-paying bodies filling the seats there. So what's happening is we have a system where kids and their parents are paying money. Kids are going through all this anguish. There's a huge, probably $200 million a year coaching industry sprung up alongside to generate data that helps colleges do their work of filling their class. And the test score is really a very inaccurate measure. Even the test makers admit that the test, the SAT, does not predict as well how well someone will do in college as the person's high school record. It says the registration guide says your high school record, your grades, class rank, etc., is the best single indicator of how well you will do in college. So why do we need the SAT at all?
on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Bob Schaefer, Public Education Director of Fair Test. How can people get in touch with Fair Test?
The best way is to go to our website at www.fairtest, and that's one word, fairtest.org. And there's lots of information there and ways to get even more.
Ted Spencer, Director of Admissions, University of Michigan, and Eugene Garcia, Dean of the Graduate School of Education, UC Berkeley, and Chair of the Latino Eligibility Task Force. And remember, folks, if you don't have a computer yourself, you can always go to your public library, and you can go online there. Next up, we're going to hear one of the last speeches of Malcolm X. You are listening to Democracy Now! 36 years ago today, Malcolm X was assassinated as he was speaking at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. Columbia University and the Daughters of Malcolm X are marking the anniversary with the announcement of a project to archive the slain leader's personal papers and to create an electronic version of his autobiography. The project, to be completed over the next decade, will also include interviews with 200 of Malcolm X's relatives and contemporaries, a new biography, and a collection of his speeches, essays, and letters. Accolades and recognition, like those given today by Columbia, would have been unthinkable 36 years ago by an institution like Columbia. Then Malcolm X was a revolutionary leader at the height of his powers, an inspiration to many in the United States and around the world who were demanding radical change. And he attracted enemies. The speech we're about to hear was given the day after his house was firebombed. A week later, Malcolm X was gunned down as he was addressing an audience in Harlem. This is a speech he gave on February 14, 1965, in Michigan.
Distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, friends and enemies, I want to point out first that I'm very happy to be here this evening, and I'm thankful for the invitation to come here to Detroit this evening. I was in a house last night that was bombed, my own, but it didn't destroy all my clothes at all, but you know what happens when fire dashes through it. They get smoky. The only thing I could get my hands on before leaving was what I have on now. It isn't something that made me lose confidence in what I'm doing, because my wife understands, and I have children from this size on down, and even in their young age, they understand. I think they would rather have a father or a brother or whatever the situation may be who will take a stand in the face of any kind of reaction from narrow-minded people rather than to compromise and later on have to grow up in shame and in disgrace. So I just ask you to excuse my appearance. I don't normally come out in front of people without a shirt and a tie. I guess that's somewhat a holdover from the Black Muslim movement, which I was in. And that's one of the good aspects of that movement. It teaches you to be very careful and conscious of how you look, which is a positive contribution on their part. But that positive contribution on their part is greatly offset by too many other liabilities. Tonight, we want to discuss, and by the way, also when I came here today, I was a bit, last night when the temperature was about 20 above, and when this explosion took place, I was caught in what I had on, some pajamas, and in trying to get my family out of the house, none of us stopped for any clothes at that point. So we were out in the 20-degree cold. I myself was. I had gotten them into the house of the neighbor next door. And so I thought perhaps being in that condition for so long, I would get pneumonia or a cold or something like that. So a doctor came today, nice doctor too, and he shot something in my arm that naturally put me to sleep. I've been back there asleep ever since the program started in order to get back in shape. So if I have a tendency to stutter or slow down, it's still the effects of that drug. I don't know what kind it was, but it was good. It makes you sleep. There's nothing like sleeping through a whole lot of excitement. Tonight, one of the things that has to be stressed is that which has not only the United States very much worried, but which also has France, Great Britain, and most of the powers who formerly were known as colonial powers worried also. And that primarily is the African Revolution. They're more concerned with the revolution that's taking place on the African continent than they are with the revolution in Asia and in Latin America. And this is because there are so many people of African ancestry that's within the domestic confines or jurisdiction of these various governments. There are four different types of people in the Western Hemisphere, all of whom have Africa as a common heritage, common origin. And that's those of our people in Latin America who are black, but who are in the Spanish-speaking areas. As many of them oftentimes migrate back to Spain, only the only difference being Spain has such bad economic conditions until many of the people from Latin America don't think it's worthwhile to migrate back there. And then the British and the French had a great deal of control in the Caribbean, in the West Indies. And so now you have many people from the West Indies migrating to both England and France. The people from the British West Indies go to France, go to Paris, go to London, and those from the French West Indies go to Paris. And it has put France and England since World War II in the precarious position of having a sort of a commonwealth structure that makes it easy for all of the people in the commonwealth territories to come into their country with no restrictions. So there's an increasing number of dark-skinned people in England and also in France. And when I was in Africa in May, I noticed a tendency on the part of the Afro-Americans to what I call lollygag. Everybody else who was over there had something on the ball, something that they were doing, something constructive. For instance, in Ghana, just to take Ghana as an example, there would be many refugees in Ghana from South Africa, but those who were in Ghana were organized and were serving as pressure groups. Some were training for military, some were being trained in how to be soldiers, but others were involved as a pressure group or a lobby group to let the people of Ghana never forget what's happening to the brother in South Africa. Also, you'd have brothers there from Angola, Mozambique, but all of the Africans who were exiled from their particular country and would be in a place like Ghana or Tanganyika, now Tanzania, they would be training. Their every move would still be designed to offset what was happening to their people back home where they had left. The only difference on the continent was the American Negro. Those who were over there weren't even thinking about these over here. This was the basic difference. The Africans, when they escaped from their respective countries that were still colonized, they didn't try and run away from the problem. But as soon as they got where they were going, they then began to organize into pressure groups to get governmental support at the international level against the injustices that they were experiencing back home. As I said, the American Negro, or the Afro-American who was in these various countries, some working for this government, some working for that government, some just in business, they were just socializing. They had turned their back on the cause over here. They were partying, you know. And when I went through one country in particular, I heard a lot of their complaints, and I didn't make any move on them. But when I got to another country, I found the Afro-Americans there were making the same complaints. And so we sat down and talked, and we organized a branch in this particular country
a branch of the OAA, of the OAAU, Organization of Afro-American Unity. And that one was the only one in existence at that time. And then during the summer, when I went back to Africa, I was able to, in each country that I had American community together, and organize them and make them aware of their responsibility to those of us who are still here in the lion's den. And they began to do this quite well. And when I got to Paris and London, there are many Afro-Americans in Paris and many in London. And in December, no, November, we organized a group in Paris, and just within a very short time, they had grown into a well-organized unit, and they, in conjunction with the African community, invited me to Paris Tuesday to address a large gathering of Parisians and Afro-Americans and Caribbean, people from the Caribbean and also from Africa, who were interested in our struggle in this country and the rate of progress that we have been making. But since the French government and the British government and this government here, the United States, knows that I have been almost fanatically stressing the importance of the Afro-American uniting with the African and working as a coalition, especially in areas which are of mutual benefit to all of us. And the government...
Malcolm X giving a speech in Detroit a week before he was assassinated the Audubon Ballroom 36 years ago today in Harlem, New York. We're going to go back to that speech in just a minute here on Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. And on this 36th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, we bring you one of his last speeches given a week before he was killed, this speech given in Detroit, Michigan.
In areas which are of mutual benefit to all of us. And the governments in these different places were frightened because they know that the black revolution is taking place on the outside of their house. And I might point out right here that you have colonialism or imperialism, as the slave system of the West is called, is not something that's just confined to England or France or the United States. But the interests in this country are in cahoots with the interests in France and the interests in Britain. And by this one huge complex or combine, and it creates what's known as not the American power structure or the French power structure, but it's an international power structure. And this international power structure is used to suppress the masses of dark-skinned people all over the world and exploit them of their natural resources. So that the era in which you and I have been living during the past 10 years, most specifically, has witnessed the upsurge on the part of the black man in Africa against the power structure. He wants his freedom. And now, mind you, the power structure is international. And as such, its own domestic base is in London, in Paris, in Washington, D.C., and so forth. And the outside or external phase of the revolution, which is manifest in the attitude and action of the Africans today, is troublesome enough. The revolution on the outside of the house or the outside of the structure is troublesome enough. But now the powers that be are beginning to see that this struggle on the outside by the black man is infecting the black man who is on the inside of that structure. I hope you understand what I'm trying to say. Newly awakened people all over the world pose a problem for what's known as Western interests, which is imperialism, colonialism, racism, and all these other negative isms or vulturistic isms. And just as the external forces pose a grave threat, they can now see that the internal forces pose an even greater threat. But the internal forces pose an even greater threat only when they have properly analyzed the situation and know what the stakes really are. Just by advocating a coalition of Africans, Afro-Americans, Arabs, Asians, who live within the structure, it automatically has upset France, which is supposed to be one of the most liberal countries on earth, and it made them expose their hand. England the same way, and I don't have to tell you about this country that we're living in now. So when you count the number of dark-skinned people in the Western Hemisphere, you can see that there are probably over 100 million. When you consider Brazil as two-thirds what we would call colored or non-white, and Venezuela and the Honduras and the other Central American countries, Cuba and the Jamaica and the United States and even Canada, when you total all these people up, you have probably over 100 million. And this 100 million on the inside of the power structure today is what is causing a great deal of concern for the power structure itself. Not a great deal of concern for all white people, but a great deal of concern for most white people. See, if I said all white people, then they would call me a racist for giving a blanket condemnation of things. And this is true. This is how they do. They take one little word out of what you say, ignore all the rest, and then begin to magnify it all over the world to make you look like what you actually aren't. And I'm very used to that. So we saw that the first thing to do was to unite our people, not only unite us internally, but we have to be united with our brothers and sisters abroad. And it was for that purpose that I spent 5 months in the Middle East and Africa during the summer. And the trip was very enlightening, inspiring, and fruitful. I didn't go into any African country or any country in the Middle East for that matter and run into any closed door, closed mind, or closed heart. I found a warm reception and an amazingly deep interest and sympathy for the black man in this country in regards to our struggle for human rights. While I was traveling, I had a chance to speak in Cairo, or rather Alexandria, with President Nasser for about an hour and a half, who's a very brilliant man, and I can see why they're so afraid of him. And they are afraid of him. They know he can cut off their oil. And actually, the only thing power respects is power. And whenever you find a man who's in a position to show power against power, then that man is respected. But you can take a man who has power and love him all the rest of your life, and non-violently and forgivingly and all the rest of those off-time things, and you won't get anything out of it. So I also had a chance to speak to President Nyerere in Tanganyika, which is now Tanzania, and also Kenyatta, all of whom I know that all of you know him. He was the head of the Mau Mau, which really brought freedom to many of the African countries. This is true. The Mau Mau played a major role in bringing about freedom for Kenya, and not only for Kenya, but other African countries, because what the Mau Mau did frightened the white man so much in other countries until he said, well, I better get this thing straight before some of them pop up here. And this is good to study because you see what makes him react. And nothing lovingly makes him react. And nothing forgiving makes him react. The only time he reacts is when he knows you can hurt him. And when you let him know you can hurt him, he has to think two or three times before he tries to hurt you. But if you're not going to do nothing but return that hurt with love, why, good night. He knows you're out of your mind. And also, I had an opportunity to speak with President Azikiwe in Nigeria, President Nkrumah in Ghana, and President Sekou Touré in Guinea. And in all of these people, I found nothing but warm friendship, sympathy, and a desire to help the black man in this country in fighting our problem. And we have a very complex problem. Now, I hope you forgive me for just speaking so informally tonight, but I frankly think it's always better to be informal. As far as I'm concerned, I can speak to people better in an informal way than I can with all of this stiff formality that ends up meaning nothing. Plus, when people are informal, they're relaxed. When they're relaxed, the mind is more open, and they can weigh things more objectively. And whenever you and I are discussing our problems, we need to be very objective, very cool, calm, collected. But that doesn't mean we should always be. There's a time to be cool and a time to be hot. And see, you got messed up into thinking that there's only one time for everything. There's a time to love and a time to hate. Even Solomon said that, and he was in that book too. You just taking something out of the book that fits your cowardly nature. And when you don't want to fight, you say, well, Jesus said don't fight. But I don't even believe Jesus said that. Also, I am very pleased to see so many who have come out to always see for yourself, where you can hear for yourself and then think for yourself. Then you'll be in a better position to make an intelligent judgment for yourself. But if you form the habit of listening to what others say about something or someone, or reading what someone else has written about someone, somebody can confuse you and misuse you. So as Afro-Americans or black people here in the Western Hemisphere, you and I have to learn to weigh things for ourselves. No matter what the man says, you better look into it. And a good example of why it's so important to look into things for yourself. I was on a plane between Algiers and Geneva, and it just happened that two other Americans were sitting in the two seats next to me. None of us knew each other, and the other two were white, one a male, the other a female. And after we had been flying along for about 40 minutes, the lady, she says, could I ask you a personal question? I said, yes. She said, well, she had been looking at my briefcase, and she said, well, what does that X? She says, what kind of last name could you have that begins with X? So I said, that's it, X. And she said, well, what does the M stand for? I said, Malcolm. So she was quiet for about 10 minutes. And she turned to me and she says, you're not Malcolm X. You see, we had been riding along in a nice conversation, like three human beings, you know, no hostility, no animosity. Just human. And she couldn't take this. She said, well, you're not who I was looking for, you know? And she ended up telling me that she was looking for horns and all that, and for someone who was out to kill all white people, as if all white people could be killed. This was her general attitude, and this attitude had been given her, this image had been given her by the press. So, before I get involved in anything nowadays, I have to straighten out my own position. And which is clear, I am not a racist in any form whatsoever. I don't believe in any form of racism. I don't believe in any form of discrimination or segregation. I believe in Islam. I'm a Muslim. And there's nothing wrong with being a Muslim. Nothing wrong with the religion of Islam. That just teaches us to believe in Allah as the God, and those of you who are Christians probably believe in the same God. Because I think you believe in the God who created the universe, and that's the one we believe in, the one who created the universe. The only difference being, you call him God, and we call him Allah. Jews call him Jehovah. If you could understand Hebrew, you'd probably call him Jehovah too. If you can understand Arabic, you'd probably call him Allah. But since the white man, your friend, took your language away from you during slavery, the only language you know is his language, you know, your friend's language. So you call him, you call for the same God he calls for. When he's putting a rope around your neck, you call for God, he calls for God. And you wonder why the one you call on never answers you. So that once you realize that I believe in the Supreme Being who created the universe and believe in him as being one, I also have been taught in Islam that one God who only has one religion, and that religion is called Islam, and all of the prophets who came forth taught that religion. Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, all of them. And by believing in one God and one religion and all of the prophets, it creates unity. There's no room for argument, no need for us to be arguing with each other. And also in that religion, the real religion of Islam. And when I was in the Black Muslim movement, they didn't have the real religion of Islam in that movement. It was something else. But the real religion of Islam doesn't teach anyone to judge another human being by the color of his skin. The yardstick that is used by the Muslim to measure another man is not the man's color, but the man's deeds, the man's conscious behavior, the man's intentions. And when you use that as a standard of measurement or judgment, you never go wrong. But when you just judge a man because of the color of his skin, then you're committing a crime, because that's the worst kind of judgment. If you judge him just because he was a Jew, that's not as bad as judging him because he's black, because the Jew can hide his religion. He can say he's something else, and which a lot of them do that. They say they're something else. But the black man can't hide. When they start indicting us because of our color, that means we're indicted before we're born, which is the worst kind of crime that can be committed. And the Muslim religion has eliminated all tendencies to judge a man according to the color of his skin, but rather the judgment is based upon his deeds. And when, prior to going to into the Muslim world, Elijah Muhammad had taught us that the white man could not enter into Mecca in Arabia, and all of us who followed him, we believed it.
Malcolm X speaking in Detroit, Michigan on February 14, 1965. 36 years ago today, a week after this speech, he was assassinated in Harlem, New York. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. If you'd like to write to us, send us email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!